listening to the
Tailcoats
and Tiaras podcast. A podcast where we talk about movies and the costumes in them. And there's more than that, but you'll figure it out. I'm Anne, and I am not a fashion history expert because I don't have a degree or anything, at least not yet. I would love to someday, but I've done a lot of research, and I'd at least like to say I know more than the average person. Anyone want to talk about your background, Sky?
Yeah, so I'm Sky. I went to school to study theatrical design, and I did not study analyzing design, but more creating costumes, which is very different because you don't have to, well, it's just the complete opposite, because when you're creating a design, you're going off of like character psychology and what the director wants and the actors or choreographers or whatever. But when you're analyzing a design, you're going, now what the heck was this designer thinking?
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a lot of evidence, so it's mostly just me being, what's that word?
Creative?
No. It's an S word.
So, smart?
Well, it's just me trying to figure out what they're thinking.
So basically, we're both two unprofessionals. That's not a word.
Amateurs. Amateurs, thanks, honey. That's what I'm here for.
Yep. Well, this is off to a great start. So this is our podcast. With both our backgrounds, we're going to like talk about different movies or shows or whatever. And, you know, discuss the costumes. Sky's going to talk about his perspective of
being an artist.
thank you. And I'm going to talk more from a, you know, historical perspective. So like most of the movies we're going to watch will at least have some, you know, historical basis, even if it's like mixed with fantasy or whatever, you know. Yeah, we're going to be talking about the 2017 Beauty and the Beast live action remake with Emma Watson. So do you want to, like, I guess we could, like, even go just from the beginning of the movie. Not the whole movie, but, you know, talk as we go.
Mm-hmm. Well, I sort of have my notes organized
I don't. So how about we go by your notes, and I will piggyback off of that.
So, Beauty and the Beast, the costume was designed by Jacqueline Duran, and I'm really sorry. The designer is Magic, and I said that wrong.
If the designer is what?
Magically
loving?
Listening.
Oh, listening. Sorry. The recording is like doing a weird bling beeping thing.
Oh. Getting a text or a call.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ignore it.
Okay. Anyway. She worked very hard to be faithful to the original animated film. So, according to Vox, she pretty much just put an 18th century twist to it and added some real life details to get off the ideas of the animation while making them three-dimensional.
I can absolutely agree with that. I would say a lot there are certainly inaccuracies, but it's very clear that the inaccuracies were, like, not because she didn't know what she was doing. She absolutely researched, I can tell. Like, there is something, and just to give you one of my sources, Frockflix, which is, I think, they also have a podcast, but this is actually just from an article they wrote, and there was very specific, you can probably hear me leafing through my notes, but very specific fabric and like a certain garment that they hadn't seen. I think it was called a drulet. What I wrote on the notes is 1770s to 1780s style jacket worn specifically in Arles. She really had to do a lot of research, and basically it's rarely, if ever, depicted on screen. I'm gonna just go online and look up Drulé jacket so that when our listeners, you know, if they want to look it up too.
You should say how to spell it.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Droulet. But if you want to actually find it, because it's going to be hard to just Google just that, I would go to Frockflix and look at their article on the 2017 Beauty and the Beast. And they talk about that specific jacket and how impressed they were to find that, because it's such a very specific piece that, you know, you would really have to do some digging to find it. Same with Provençal fabrics, which, I mean, this is sort of jumping ahead, but you know that in the library scene, Belle's wearing that bodice that's like rose vines almost. It's like really, like, looks like an IKEA pattern, basically. Yeah. Uh-huh. So that's Provençal imported into like the Provence area of France from India. So it was either, like, you know, it could be from India or just a recreation made in France inspired by that. But those were, like, really popular, and they eventually came about later, but they started out in this, you know, they would go in through Marseille and the sort of the south of France is where they would be starting. And there's a lot of that in there. So, like, there's that specific one is what I remember, or the lining on her cape when she's, like, first entering the castle. So there's, like, that really floral lining print. There's some other dresses in there, like the villagers have that. Even her, and, like, while her bloomers that she's wearing technically aren't like 18th century accurate, they do have that pattern that is accurate to that. So, yeah.
They also have that pattern on one of her aprons.
They also have what?
That pattern on one of her aprons. Actually, I think it's on two of them.
Like the similar, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, the winter.
They have the same one as the bodice on one of her aprons. Yeah, I think it's the winter one. I'm trying to find the picture of the frickin', what did you call it?
The Drulé?
Yeah, the thing that I can't say because it's in French.
Droulet. I'm guessing how it's pronounced, but, you know. Drulé. I'm going to, maybe Drulé, 18th century. Google that.
I found it!
Yeah.
Oh my god!
Isn't it weird looking?
But to describe this odd coat that Anne attempted to describe to you guys, it's basically like a camisole and a tailcoat together. So it's got the sleeves and the cut of a camisole, but then it's got four pleats that go down to, like, ankle length, it looks like.
Kind of. But it's more like, but the weird thing about it is that if you see it from the front, you only see, like, the arms.
Yeah.
Basically. So it's not even, like, it's a really thin back. It's not really on and around your back. It's not a warm thing.
It's like a camisole you'd wear to a first communion, just to cover up your shoulders so you look all, what's that word? Conservative.
Okay. Yeah, but then it all has, like, things hanging down in the back.
Yeah. It's very cute, actually. I want one. I need to own it. Maybe that'll be my inspiration for my wedding suit.
Yes.
Oh, my mother's going to hear this now. She's going to think I want to get married. I just want the embroidery.
Yes.
Oh my god, there's so much beautiful embroidery in this freaking Beauty and the Beast. Okay, it's not all embroidery, but, like, the details on everything, even just the lace on Gaston's red coat.
The lace on the coat itself?
Ribbon.
The ribbon.
The ribbon.
Let me look it up.
Yes. Not the leather one. The one that looks a little bit more like the animation brought to life. It's extremely detailed, and it's just so gorgeous and really emphasizes his cocky nature.
And he has, like, a really classic style, 18th century, like, menswear. And you know what I learned? This is so, so fascinating. If you look at a picture of his red, like, I'm going to say vest because that's what you'll understand as. It's not actually called that at the time, but you know what I mean. You see the buttons underneath the pocket flaps?
Yes.
Okay. So what I learned And I find this fascinating because you know how women's jeans today, sometimes they, I mean, first of all, women's dresses, we all get really excited when we have buttons in our dresses. Or, I mean, I guess you're not a woman, but you like to wear dresses. You know what it's like to wear a dress and not have pockets, right? And how exciting it is when they do have pockets.
Yeah.
Okay. So back in the 18th century, women had pockets and they were functional. They weren't like those stupid decorative pockets we get in like our jeans that are like, why did you sew this in? What's the point?
Mm-hmm.
That's what, like, so the buttons on the men's flaps are just there like to be decorative. And I just got so excited because it's like, finally, the roles are reversed. Not really, but somewhat. Because those buttons do not serve a function. They don't, I mean, yes, the flap still opens to be a pocket, but the buttons are just there for no reason, and that made me excited. And women's pockets, oh my gosh. Okay, so you know that, like, Belle in like, the first town scene where she has that pocket outside of her dress?
Yeah, that's how they made them in France at the time, right?
Well, okay, I tried not to do too much research on what the costumer was doing, because I know that was your job, but I did come across a little bit about how she said, you know, normally that like they were actually worn underneath, but if it was worn underneath, you wouldn't be able to see it and you wouldn't know that it was there. And like the whole point was that Belle was practical. So, and there are instances where they were worn on the outside. You know, it's not like they never were, but typically what was done is like they would have a shift underneath and like just a whole bunch of different layers. The shift is like the first layer that goes under the stays, which I will talk about because there was a whole corset controversy thing, which I have to get into, but we'll get to that later. So this actually I got from National Museums Liverpool YouTube channel, and it's called Getting Dressed in the 18th Century. So yeah, they would start with a shift, and then they would put on over-the-knee stockings tied with a ribbon garter. I think this is a British source, so it could have been slightly different in France. But they'd wear, like, what they called a dicky petticoat, which was a knee-length white linen. And then after that would go the stays. And, yeah, so after the stays is when they would put on the pockets. Now, these were, like, what Belle had, but often there were two of them. And you would, like, tie them around the waist with, like, a string. And it would be, like, one on each side, usually. And so then the, you know, a pannier or hip pad. And so then they'd wear at least one full-length linen petticoat, which, or they could have, you know, another layer with wool for the winter. But the way it went on is basically imagine, and you might want to look this up, just 18th century petticoat, just to get a visual. It was like two aprons sewn together, but there was like a separation. So you could like tie the apron in back first and then tie it in front. And then there would be openings at the sides.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would be able to reach in to the pockets. And it's amazing because then you would put like another petticoat that, and that would also have like the openings for the pockets. So not only would they have pockets, but because of the gathers and, like, the skirts, they'd be invisible, you know, so you could access them easily. And I'm just, like, really geeking out about how practical 18th century women's clothing could be, despite the stereotypes, because it was super practical. And then there was something called a stomacher. So the thing about 18th century dresses is that they are not put on the way we would put on a dress today. A stomacher is, like, the is basically the bodice minus the sleeves and the back and everything. It's like just like a triangle that goes in front. And the importance of the stays, which are what they called the corset of the 18th century, is that, you know, you would pin the stomacher onto the stays. Now imagine pinning something onto just a shift or an undershirt. Does that sound practical?
No.
No, right? So one of the reasons for the stays, it was almost like, you know, like armor against the pinning. Mm-hmm. So you could pin the stomacher on, and then you would pin, like, the portion called the gown over that. And again, I highly recommend looking this stuff up, because it's hard to visualize. But, you know, after you pin on the stomacher, you put on the gown, and then they would put on a fichu, or a kerchief, or, you know, a neckerchief, like lots of different words for it. But that was basically what, and you see Belle has that in her town costume. It's like kind of like a inside scarf thing tucked into the bodice.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of looks like a collar, but it's actually a separate thing, most likely. You see how it's kind of tucked in there?
Yeah, I saw it.
Yeah, so that thing is was basically what they would wear to protect from the sun, you know, or keep warm, or for modesty, like, usually worn during, like, you know, just daily wear. And I kind of interrupted you, so go ahead.
In the village, we see Belle wearing a shift. She has a blue A-line skirt and a bodice with thin lacing on the left side. The rest of the female characters, well, the ones around her age had lacing down the middle, not on the side. I actually found some critiques on that as well, because people were saying that, you know, it doesn't have support and there's no lacing, so it's historically inaccurate. But it does have lacing. The lacing's just down the side, so it's not easy to see. And they actually talked about, in an interview with Durin, she said that she'd been working with Emma Watson on the costume, and Emma Watson said that she didn't want to have a corset or anything restrictive, which they'd both agreed on, because if she was wearing something restrictive, it's illogical that her character would be doing all of these activities like climbing and running and riding a horse. She wouldn't have all of the flexibility to be an active heroine.
So I both agree and disagree with that. I'm gonna bring in two perspectives. So first, there is the, you know, perspective you showed, which, yes, to an extent, I can agree that Hollywood, the way Hollywood uses corsets, is usually not healthy. Okay, so if they were to put Emma Watson in a corset for this, often what Hollywood does is tightens them way too tight, because they want, you know, they want to look sexy or whatever. That's just Hollywood. Mm-hmm. So a lot of complaints you get about corsets and just wearing any boned bodice is because of what Hollywood's doing. And so the assumption then comes from, you know, and it's even from like stuff like Gone with the Wind, you know, you get this stereotype that they had these teeny, teeny, tiny waists back in the olden days, and that, you know, they can move or do anything in them. And that's not really accurate. Like, the people who did do that, like, existed, you know. I'm like the Scarlett O'Hara's of the day. Certainly. Also, just pointing out, Scarlett O'Hara is from the 1860s, and this is the 1700s, so that's a completely different corset altogether. It's not the same thing. But they were made, like, if they were made well, stays, and when I say stays, that's the equivalent of a corset of the day. They were more to, like, as I said before, help with the pinning, so, like, kind of create a protection for that. And they did sort of, like, adjust the shape, but it shouldn't have felt uncomfortable. It would feel like kind of like a, as American Duchess describes it, like a hug, but you could still do things. It was like a bra. Most people today, I mean, you could go out and do things without a bra, but a bra is not going to stop you from riding a horse or, you know, riding a bike, I guess, or whatever. So if they were wearing these every single day, it's just unrealistic that they would be as tight as they make them to be in movies. So I'm glad the costumer understood that. I also have this theory that she didn't really refuse to wear a corset. I have this theory that she more was like, I'd rather not wear a corset. And then they were like, ooh, everyone knows Emma Watson's like a feminist. If we made this like a big public thing, that'll get like people excited about the movie. I feel like it was more of a publicity thing. That's just my guess. Like, I'm sure she actually did say she didn't want to wear a corset, but I doubt it was this big thing of people trying to make her, and she was like, no, I'm not wearing one.
They never said that she refused to wear a corset. Right. They just said that she didn't want to.
Yeah.
But that also goes towards, like, people's views today. Like, you were talking about how Hollywood views the corset. And in order to get today's society to understand her as a heroine? Yeah. Which way is the right way to say it?
Sure. Like the drug, but not.
Yeah. You can't put her in that because the people watching it see it as restrictive, which is what you have to think about as a costumer. Is you have to go, all right, this is the historical aspect, but how is it going to be viewed in today's society? Is it going to get across the same idea? What can I do to change, alter this in order to get across the idea that I want in today's society, but still respect the historical cultures?
Right. And what I would say, though, if she were wearing proper stays, people probably, unless she took them off, like off the bodice and like showed that the stays were there, if she were wearing them properly, it would not shrink the waist. It would probably wouldn't be noticeable. And I have no issue, again, with her not wanting to wear a corset. Because here's another thing. Not all corsets were boned back then. So believe it or not, what she's wearing is sort of like an unboned corset, which I guess the closest term I could find would be jumps, which they would be called at the time. And so that was accurate. And the kind of ironic, funny thing is that another word for jumps in the 18th century, okay? So when we think corset today, we think of the 19th century corset, which is boned and you lace it and everything. Back in the 18th century, in French, a sort of like quilted like padding that was still, you know, a good foundation and would protect from the pins and would keep it, you know, sturdy, you would call the boned thing a like stays, or in French, corabelaine, which whale body, basically, because it was used whale bone. And then the unboned part, what I think in English we called jumps, and there's, you know, confusion about whether the jumps are different than, you know, other versions of this unboned thing, but the unboned one in the 18th century was actually called a corset. So, like, she's wearing, basically, by not wanting to wear a corset, she's wearing a corset, which is kind of funny. But it's not what we think of corsets. I just think it's amusing that, like, by opting not to wear a boned thing, the alternative, historical accurate alternative is jumps, or probably corset, since it would be the French term. So I guess it would be like, you know, some bras have wire underneath and some don't. This would be the non-wire bra, basically, is how I see it.
Yeah, a sports bra.
Yeah, there you go.
It is a sports corset. That is very accurate.
I thought that was funny.
Well, because of the little bits of historical inaccuracies, which there honestly are not that many of.
No. And even the inaccuracies have accuracy to them, I would say.
And they're all very purposeful and thought through. Mm-hmm. I personally think it's very fitting to the character because she's never meant to fit in. She is not attracted to the most attractive guy in town, which is a fairly significant part of her character. She has no need to impress anyone with her looks, so she just expresses herself and isn't worried about it. And which is something you really see through the bloomers, because she just lifts her skirt up and is just like, yeah, whatever. That part really pissed me off, because I was like, bloomers don't exist, and why the frick is she showing that much skin?
Really?
Yeah, that part,
that's what bothered you? Okay, I'll tell you what bothered me, but I'll tell you that later.
That pissed me off. But, I mean, I can see the logic that the designer had behind it after, like, doing some research on her goals, but it still bugs me. It doesn't feel right. But, you know, she could have made them. I thought all of that through.
People were people back then, and so I'm sure there were people who were not necessarily the norm, and so just because it's not textbook accurate, I believe if they had the resources to create something like a side sewn thing or an outside pocket or, you know, bloomers based on the pattern of breeches, you know, that is something that feasibly could have happened because they had the materials, and I can see why that would have come to her mind. If that makes sense.
Exactly.
Now, the whole, I didn't have it as much of an issue with the whole hiking the skirt up into the breeches, because since bloomers didn't exist back then.
Oh, she actually tucked it into her waistline.
Or, sorry, waistline, that's what I meant. But, like, at the time, I don't know about the whole showing skin thing, what that would have been like, because there were dresses where it was appropriate, like, to show your ankle, for instance. Like, the roba la polonaise was meant to be, like, super sexy, and I know she's not trying to be sexy, but, like, there were gowns, and she was working class also, so showing your ankles was more of a practical thing, like, that way you're not tripping over your skirts, and that wasn't as big a deal. So, and I think in the Victorian era, if you're wearing drawers, like just drawers, then that would, yeah, be like wearing your underwear. And by drawers, I mean like what you're thinking of as bloomers, but they were called drawers in the Victorian era. So I'm just using that term. So yeah, that would be like wearing underwear. But because the women did not wear bloomers or drawers back in the 18th century, I feel like her making those bloomers or, you know, cotton breeches was her way of making sure she wasn't being naked, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because the other alternative of hiking it up into the belt would just be like, whoop, nothing under there. So she actually made something to do that. And because she was like probably the first person to think of that, she's probably like, well, it's not inappropriate for men to wear breeches. Therefore, so I don't think that the showing of skin would have even like been a thought thing, because she's the first to like do it, basically.
Oh, yeah, I totally get the reason behind it. I just don't like it.
Okay, fair. You don't have to like it. I don't like, here's what I don't like. And I'm very biased because I love the original movie, and while I love the new movie, I feel like some of the things in the new movie implied that they were trying to fix what was wrong with the original. And there wasn't that much wrong with the original. Like, the fact that they made Belle the inventor feels shoehorned in a little bit, because, and it felt like they were saying to me like, oh, so being a bookworm isn't isolating enough. Like, I'm sorry, I was a bookworm in high school and we spent some time alone, and like people weren't like mean, but like in the original movie they weren't really that mean to her. Like they were clicky, but they weren't like as mean as they are in this movie, which is weird because in this movie they almost want to seem more sympathetic about the villagers, but then also, like, they're worse about it, and they, like, flip-flop. So, like, that's my critique about the movie itself. And I feel like they almost, like, tried too hard to, like, imply that, almost as if, like, oh, the original Belle wasn't feminist enough, so we're going to fix that. And I'm like, excuse me? So you're not feminist enough just because you don't also invent things on top of everything else? Like, but again, I think that's just my bias. The whole washing machine invention thing, as far as like story wise, wasn't really necessary. And the whole teaching another girl to read isn't one enough. Women read back in that day. That's not true that didn't happen. And I just have this issue with people trying to put down women of the past in order to feel empowered in the future. Like, yeah, just because women in the past were more oppressed doesn't mean that those women were less empowered in their own right. You know, just because they wore corsets did not make them lazy or delicate or whatever. It's what they did. It's like, you know, today they say, oh, well, she's dressing like a slut, so that's not cool. It's like saying, well, she's wearing a corset, so she must be a prissy or a lazy or delicate or insignificant woman. And I'm going on a rant right now, I'm realizing.
Yeah.
I'm going nuts. So much editing out I need to do.
I think you should keep that.
This is just going to be called Anne Rants, the podcast.
Hey! Anne Rants, Sky Listens.
Yeah.
Okay. So, for the live action Beauty and the Beast, they wanted to create a version of the animated dress that also showed the era, the magical aspects of making the dress, and Belle's being an active heroine.
Heroine. Just like, I know it sounds weird because it's the same pronunciation as the drug.
I really hate that word.
Yeah.
He says with a gigantic grin.
What?
He says with a gigantic grin.
Oh, I can hear it in your voice, though.
Anyway, she went through a lot of designs and shades of yellow before mm-hmm. coming up with the final design. And the way that, I don't know, I hope our listeners know this, but the way that you test colors for film or theater is you take the fabric and you put them in front of the camera or on the stage with the lighting, and you see how it's affected by all the different kinds of lighting that are going to be used and right. by the camera lens, because that all changes the color in the long run. So she went through a bunch of different shades to find the perfect shade of yellow, which is how she comes up with the one that the dress is made out of. And she went with a coat dress with a split front, which is very 18th century.
Inspired.
Yeah, she said 18th century inspired. It's constructed with petticoats and layers of satin organza, which is like a sheer silky fabric.
I know what organza is, but yeah, our listeners
don't. Sew with. It's really hard to sew with. There's three layers, which are kind of like rectangular layers that they just sew one on top of the other. And they're supposed to give the skirt the movement and reference to the ruching that we see on the original animated dress. Ruching is when you like, it's how the fabric goes up and creates little waves.
Like the gathers?
Yeah, it's like the gathers.
Okay.
In the dress. Anyway, they took a simple dress and built off of it. The details on the top two layers, according to my research, but I'm pretty sure it's just the three layers of the dress. They matched the design of the ballroom floor, and they were painted, the little details. They were painted on with gold leaf filigree, and some Swarovski crystals were added on. I put some in parentheses because they used 2,000 Swarovski crystals. yeah, it's a little insane.
My mouth is watering.
Yeah. Oh, and I also wrote in my notes, because having gold on your dress is not princessy enough. You've got to have those crystals too. So they took 180 feet of satin organza, 3,000 feet of thread, over 2,000 Swarovski crystals, and more than 12,000 hours to make the dress. But they had 18 weeks to make it, so I'm a little jealous. I work on theater productions. I don't get 18 weeks to make anything.
Right.
It's absolutely gorgeous. I can't believe that they actually did the math to find out how much freaking thread they used. Like, who does that? Her jewelry is naturesque. She has vine ear cuffs and a tree-like necklace that is meant to represent how everything in the castle is moving and growing. I thought I had more on that, but apparently that's all I have on the gold dress.
That's okay, because I've got a lot. Looking at it, I don't think 18th century. That doesn't mean it didn't have 18th century inspiration, but looking at it, I don't think of the 18th century. I just think, oh my gosh, give me that. I want that. So, you're right. In that the bodice part, well, I know it's not actually a stomacher, it could be. So, like, the triangle in front, like, this is my issue with the people, they're like, it's totally historically inaccurate. If they look at it, it's not 100% inaccurate. I mean, it is, but, like, you see where the inspiration comes from.
Yeah.
So.
That was part of what she was keeping in mind with the style that she did for the top, with having it go in the V.
Right.
To get that look.
Right,
sorry, you can continue.
No, it's okay. I've been interrupting you this whole time. Like, what? The short sleeves are... I don't dislike the short sleeves, but I don't think it would be any less flowy if the sleeves had been 3/4 length. I guess maybe because it was less movement, like, gave a little less movement, but I'm not sure I even agree with that, because her, like, celebration dress at the end, I believe, has sleeves of that length. And also it's supposed to be winter there, so I'm not sure why they went with the short sleeves, but, you know, I don't hate it either. I just think it would be a little more accurate if they had those. And if the, obviously the part in front, rather than having a zipper in the back, which yes is easier, but if we were thinking of like what would have been feasible back then, like say, like thinking of Belle actually living in the 18th century, the idea of a zipper was not conceived of yet, even with her being creative and inventive. I don't, like, it took all the way to, like, I think the end of the 19th century or beginning of the 20th century to come up with a zipper. So I don't think it's something one person could have come up with. I think it was built on ideas, building and building and building, eventually coming to that point. So
the zipper thing actually doesn't bug me, because the dress is literally made magically by a magical wardrobe, and it's sewn onto her. So I've always just thought of it as, like, the dress literally being sewn onto her.
Well, okay. Then I would say, though, why have a line in the back at all?
Well, because you cannot literally make a dress sewn onto a person if she's going to wear it many, many times.
But you could, however, make it look like that with the whole stomacher thing, which I guess is, I get is less convenient. But if you're going to work so hard on a dress, you might as well have that. Like, with the stomacher, it doesn't need that line in the back, because none of the other dresses have that. And the stomacher, you just take off, which, yeah, it could be pinned. But even, like, if you wanted to, like, use snaps, that would still be easier, and it would still give the same effect of being, like, sewn on. So I'm not sure why they didn't do that. It's really not that big of a deal. I don't care that much. It's just something I'm pointing out. But yeah, anyway, so the bodice in front, though, it has a square neckline, which is accurate for the time. So the neckline is correct. I do like that. And then even the opening in the, like, the sides. So that's similar to, if you look at, I mean, a lot of dresses of the day had that, you know, the petticoat on, like, it, normally the sides would have been attached actually to the bodice portion and go over the skirt or petticoat. The Rococo style, like, the gold, you know, that comes from, like, the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's also really nice for 18th century, because they, like, people actually
it's from embroidered. The floor.
Sorry?
It's from the floor.
Well, it's the same as the floor, but it comes from the ceiling, right? Like, in
the
movie?
Yes, yes. It's the same design as the floor. That's what I thought you were talking about.
Right, yes. It's that, too. It's all over the castle, basically. And so, yeah, with the, like, while the ear cuffs obviously are not accurate, it still has that Rococo era, you know, vibe to it. Same with the necklace. And now, I don't know about if the fabric for the dress would have necessarily existed. I know, like, silk chiffon existed, but that was more used for fichus. But, like, you know, again, Belle being creative, maybe it would have been like, I wonder what a dress made fully out of this would look like. So it's a little less feasible than I imagine, but, like, I think it's possible, you know,
Well, that specifically goes back to the magical castle aspect, because Belle didn't make this dress. It was literally made with magic.
Yeah, but she probably designed it, because there's that earlier scene where she, like, is not happy with the dress the garderobe lady made for her. So I think she probably had a say in how this dress was made.
Maybe. Or maybe, like, the beast told her what to make. That'd be so cute and romantic.
I feel like that would be not. I'd be like, don't tell me what to wear. I'm wearing whatever the heck I want.
Well, more like, oh, I think Belle would love this. Isn't it beautiful? And then she sees it and she's like, oh, this is gorgeous.
Oh, like with the library. Like, you know, she likes books, and so he designed something that he thinks she would like.
Yeah, exactly. Just like
actually, that actually makes more sense, because what do you guys know about women's fashion most of the time? No offense.
Does that solve all of your problems, Anne?
I mean, my problems with this dress make, I mean, it makes more, I mean, if the beast designed it, that would actually make more sense in this scene. So that's a good theory. I kind of like that. Anyway, so yeah, he might have found the fabric, like, for the, like, because he wouldn't, I mean, he probably doesn't know, like, what would this be used for? And then maybe the garderobe would be like, actually, you don't. And then she might have been like, boo, but that's so unique. I thought of that, you know, I don't know. Anyway, all theorizing. But to talk about the gold parts, like, there was some, you know, you were talking about the painting stuff. There were some things painted on in the 18th century. So, like, painting is not out of the question either. That's not. But I think another thing, like, you know, it kind of reminds me of the gold thread embroidery that was used in 18th century France. it was just like spun gold, like, you know, like in the story of Rumpelstiltskin, skin, like spinning gold into thread and stuff. Like, I think that probably was inspired by, you know, like royals would have gold thread, and so, and the embroidery would look a lot like that. So that's another Rococo 18th century influence on it.
I don't know the beast if his embroidery is actually embroidery or if it's painted on. It looks like it's actual embroidery.
I think his is meant to be a little more accurate than hers because it's just like his old court
Yeah.
outfits. So, I mean, it would make more sense, I think.
Well, actually, what I found very interesting about that is if we just start with like the beginning of the beast costumes, the beast, like, he starts off with his clothes being worn out and tattered. Like, his first costume is literally a cape that is just shredded patchwork.
Right. Like in the animated movie too.
And as he becomes more interested in Belle, he begins to dress nicer and his clothes get less tattered. So he starts off with a nice worn out coat and a stained shift, and then he starts to wear a blue vest. And I'm trying to use words that everyone will know.
Yeah, no, I don't worry.
minor shift. And then he starts to wear a blue dress. And all his clothes look dirty and tattered because he's been in the castle.
He's wearing a
And
blue dress.
blue vest.
Oh, okay.
He's been in the castle, and well, I don't think he's worn them for many years because he's just been in like this one super tattered thing.
Right.
But they're really old because they've survived the curse. And then his costume for the dance looks like it was just made. It's got this pristine white lace and all of the gold embellishments, and there's no sign of aging on the costume like there is in everything else.
Right.
The beast costume is also meant to reflect the magic in the castle and everything being alive with the detailed embroidery, which, oh, it's actually silver thread.
Which they used back then too, by the way. Gold was more popular, but silver, yeah, anyway, yeah.
Yeah, the thin silver thread that looks similar to tree roots.
Yes.
Well, a tree or roots is what I said. I like the idea of it being roots because the entire castle stems from him, and he's quite literally the root of the problem. Yeah, and then, like, you know, Belle has the tree necklace and the leaves, and like when she comes to the castle, life comes alive, so there's leaves growing from the castle. A bunch of like cheesy circle of life shit.
Yeah.
I like to overanalyze sometimes.
This, you're speaking to like me who's literally analyzing the historical accuracy of a fantasy film. So I do not judge.
But I could see his costume having been made magically that night as well.
Oh,
Like,
sure.
he went, I'm going to a ball with Belle and I'm really nervous and I really need a new outfit.
Yeah.
Especially considering, like, so here's the hardest time that I have with this whole thing is that he's turned into the beast. He used to be a human that was like Belle's size, and now
Yeah.
he's this gigantic freaking beast. So logically, his clothes aren't gonna fit him anymore. So maybe like other things are made out of worn out curtains or something. And then he goes, "I really need to impress Belle. Please make me something nice and new that's not out of worn out curtains."
Yeah, and I think it's not just a matter of, like, of course he wants to impress her too, but it's that he's also happier and people take care of themselves more when they're happier because they feel like they have a point in psychology.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, you can take care of yourself in the clothes that you have.
Yes, but like, unless they're
Was
too small for you.
definitely, yeah, this was definitely made specifically for the occasion with nice fabric,
Oh, absolutely.
unlike everything else that he has,
Yes.
which you really see the aging in the fabric, which is so beautiful and like I'm in love with it.
Yeah. But you can also see, like, he does have nicer clothes before that. But yeah, this one was
They're
specific.
nicer, but they're not new.
Well, he would have
You
to.
can see the aging of the fabric and how worn out it is if you look at it.
What about the scene when they're walking around in the snow?
Yeah, that fabric is still very worn out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, I can't see it close enough, so I'm just looking at pictures. But then how would he fit in? Oh, I guess he must, like you said, curtains and stuff.
Yeah.
Got it.
That's why that's my job. Mm-hmm. Okay, but then when Belle leaves, he sinks back into that depression, and he, like, you know, he doesn't wear his fancy outfit anymore. He goes back to wearing his rags, is what I wrote. And he has a very cozy looking shawl. It's not really a shawl.
I know what it is.
What is it?
It's called a, where is it? I wrote notes about that. I was excited. It's called a, don't know how it's actually pronounced, but I'm gonna guess the French way, banyan, banyan, and it's actually like, or wrapper would have been an easier way to say it. A banyan is an Indian gown. The wrapper has like Japanese influence, but it's, yeah, it's like basically like a robe, what men would wear it around the house, or like casually, or they would wear it like when just getting out of bed. It would be like a bathrobe kind of.
And this makes a lot of sense now. I was trying to figure out what the actual word was for that. I just went with shawl because, you know, it goes on you like a shawl.
Yes. The fancy shawl. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. But no, I'm glad you brought that up because I get to be excited about having done research.
But it just, it looks so cozy. And it's like,
yes,
you know, that a stereotypical girl goes through a breakup, curls up in blankets, and like devours ice cream.
Yeah, it's like what I do, except I'm married and still do that. Not out of sadness, but just because, you know, whatever.
Okay, but it makes me think of that, like the comfort, yes, of the blanket, and you're just like, oh, so cuddly. Yes. Oh, so I have another fun fact for you. Belle's dress at the end of the movie, you know, the white one with the like beautiful freaking flowers painted on it. I don't actually know.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about?
I know what you're talking about. I'm not a huge fan of that dress, but yes.
Okay, well, just wait.
Okay.
So the dress, that specific dress has a print from an original 18th century apron that the costume designer bought in like college.
I love that.
Yeah. I thought that was really cool. And I was like, ah, must tell Anne.
Part of that makes me a little bit sad though, because like, you have an original 18th century print. Why would you not use that to make an 18th century looking dress?
I mean, it's the apron that she has. It's not a dress.
Okay. That's fine. That's okay. You're right.
And like, you wouldn't want to use your fancy, really nice 18th century apron on set because it could get destroyed and then you'd be miserable.
That's true. That makes me a little happier. I like the bottom of the dress. I do like the design now that I'm looking at it. Yeah, it's very pretty. The top part of it, I mean, the design, like the shape, I like the fabric on the skirt, I will say. But the top part, which I liked from the picture because I kind of like that 3D effect. But like altogether, it kind of reminds me of a Hawaiian shirt and I'm not thrilled about it.
Yeah, I didn't really like that dress very much either. I don't know.
I love the fun fact, though.
Yeah, I didn't feel like the print really matched the style.
Yeah.
But also, it's really cool that it's from an actual 18th century apron.
I know. That's exciting. And I'm looking at the bottom, like, you can't really see it as much in the movie because you don't see the bottom, but the bottom part does look more 18th century print than I think the top does, so.
Yeah. And I mean, the whole thing might not actually be from that print. It could just be that that's incorporated into it.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah. Like,
and, like, that's the inspiration. But.
But that's awesome. Like,
I know, right?
Yeah.
I want that apron.
Same. Yeah, but the dress, like, see, this is the dress that, like, the way people had problems with the yellow dress for being inaccurate is more what I have a problem with this dress for. Maybe I would like it better if I just liked the dress better. But it's okay. But it doesn't have a square neckline. It does have the 3/4 length sleeves, so that's cool. But I don't know.
It's yeah, whatever.
See, I wish those sleeves were on the yellow dress.
Yeah.
Not in white, obviously. But
in yellow, yeah. Excuse me while I go make that version. Just kidding. I don't have money for fabric. Okay, do you want to talk about another costume?
Yeah, just like the general, oh my god, wait, I have to go back to LeFou though, because as you know, he's my favorite character.
Absolutely.
I don't have a lot of notes on his costume, but he has to be mentioned. So he has this red velvet vest and like a silky magenta bow, which is definitely not actually silk. It's probably like a satin poly blend because it's thick enough to hold up itself. But oh my god, it's so beautiful and it just makes me really happy. And then for the like more iconic costume, Duran used a blue I typed a blue coat. Whoops. A blue coat instead of brown, which looks much better on the actor, and the vest that they used is brown then instead of the traditional red, which they used earlier. It's not like his costumes look incredibly flamboyant, but they're very well put together.
All the guy costumes are flamboyant in the 18th century, so like...
Okay, that's fair. But, like, not to the point where it stands out.
Right.
Okay, so anyway, the animated characters, what I was going to talk about at the very beginning of this podcast. my favorite part about the movie is the animated characters' costumes when they come to life, because they're still representative of the objects that we met them as.
Yes.
So, like, Cogsworth is the most obvious one. He's the clock. He has Roman numeral buttons. And
are you serious?
Yeah, his buttons are Roman numerals. And they look like the ones that are on his clock.
Oh my gosh.
The colors in his costume and the details are like those on the clock that he was before. So, like, the colors are a little faded on the clock, but it's, I feel like if you cleaned the clock up, the nice burgundy-esque red that he has would match the color on the clock. Mm-hmm. And his coat is gold, and the details on it look like the artwork done in the clock. And then he has five valors, like military valors, and the clock has a depiction of military supplies. So there's a cannon.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, it's really awesome. That's like the most nerd-worthy character coming to life thing that I have. And then there's Mrs. Pott. If you just look at her dress, it is so gorgeous. It's really similar to the one on the pot, and it's got the same shades. Well, just the same shades on it, which I'm so impressed that they got the same colors in all of these costumes.
And it's interesting because that's what she's wearing also in the prologue, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And it's interesting because, you know, like she's a maid or housekeeper or something, right?
Yep.
And it's a little bit more like middle class style of the 18th century versus everybody else in the prologue who's wearing what is called the robe à la française. But then you have Mrs. Potts, who's like, you know, more middle class, and it's they also mentioned the cap that she's wearing is more like early 18th century, but it is something that like would have been worn, same as like her hairstyle would have been early 18th century. Don't know if she's supposed to be that old, but it's interesting that it's more early 18th century than the rest.
Yeah, I very much like the detail of the cap because aesthetically it makes me think of the top of the teapot.
Yeah.
You know, the stem where, like, you lift up the top?
Right.
Yeah. I thought that detail was amazing.
I love the cap.
Even the piano player, his mustache matches the candles where you put your sheet music.
Yeah.
The way that it curves up is the same way that his mustache curves.
I did notice that, and I love it.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite details. I love that even their hair fits into the animated objects.
Okay, do we have anything else about the actual, you know,
talk? Hair. I'm going to talk about hair.
Go for it. I'm going
to
keep looking.
Just to debunk some. Okay, first of all, my source is American Duchess, and they are amazing. They do a lot of research on, like, especially the 18th century. They have a whole, like, book, I think American Duchess's Guide to 18th Century Dressmaking, I think is one of them. And the other one is, I believe, called American Duchess's Guide to 18th Century Beauty. And they actually talk about, like, recipes of, like, how they made the pomade and the powder. And they do a lot of debunking of myths of people from the past. So you know how I went on that rant about the corset thing? Mm-hmm. I kind of get that from them because they really, like, do a deep dive into, like, okay, people living back then, what is actually realistic? And then they find evidence of that. And so makeup also, I want to talk about that. So the makeup in the movie is not quite, I'm going to actually start with that because that's shorter. I would say the makeup, like with the prints and stuff, is sort of, I'd say maybe inspired by 18th century, but it's not really, it's more, you know, fantastical.
Makeup with the prints. Are you talking more like the beginning and the end?
The beginning. I mean, the end, he's not really wearing makeup.
Oh, that's true. Oh, you mean his super fancy makeup.
The poof poof, whatever.
Yeah.
But makeup was more like, there's this theory that they wore white lead to create that white face, you know, foundation from back then. And that is sort of true. Like, there were people who did that. But as American Duchess puts it, it's like, you know, there are also people today who get plastic surgery. But that's not everybody. It's the extremes. So, yeah, probably the royals would be more likely to have that, but they also, like, knew it was bad at the time. There was evidence, like, quotes of the time. They knew that lead was bad and they used it anyway, kind of like how today people know things are bad and they use them anyway. So that was a possibility, but they, you know, there were other ways to create that white face powder too, and not everybody really wore it. Even again, it was more of like the extreme people who would wear it. A lot of people just, you know, wanted it a little more natural and have your face more, like, glow naturally and emphasis on the eyes. So, like, they would have, like, dark eyebrows. And this is men and women. You know, dark eyebrows were a big deal. Or some other rumor that there was, they would use actual mouse fur or whatever to use, like, make fake eyebrows. I don't, like, there's no real evidence if that's true. It may have been, but again, I think that's more of a, you know, extremist thing. What they actually mostly used were burnt cloves, and that would just work as like an eyebrow pencil. It would create the same like darkening, and it would work really well. And it was and cloves were actually insect deterrents. There's also this belief that everybody had lice and bugs in their hair, da 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 da. But the stuff they used in their hair, the pomade, they often used a lot of clove in it, and that like made bugs not want to go in because it smelled so strongly of that, and they put like, you know, stuff like lemon or lavender or whatever into their products. So really this myth that they always had bugs in their hair is not really true. Like, sure, probably they did, but they also didn't just like let them stay there. They like got rid of them, you know. And so cloves for the eyebrows. They did wear some like rouge, and it's made from a brandy base, and you know, obviously don't drink it because that's not good, but it would leave it like a stain on the cheeks that would stay pretty much, you know, the entire day, which I kind of want some now myself too, because apparently it like the stuff they use to create it like has a nice color that blends to the person's skin tone, and that could also be used on lips. But they would use other things on lips too. They'd make like a balm or whatever. They had ways of doing things with completely, you know, non-toxic things. While the toxic ones did exist, that's not like what everybody did, okay? So, wigs and hair. The prince's wig in the beginning, mostly accurate. I think it would have been more like a ponytail in the back, rather than just long and flowing. But it's still pretty, and I don't have an issue with it. So, how did they take care of their hair back then? Again, a lot of this is from American Duchess, but they would make pomade, which was made out of different, like, animal fats as a base, which you think, oh, that sounds gross. But also, we have lipstick that is made out of beetle carcasses today. So,
yeah, I think it sounds perfectly logical to make it out of.
Yeah, well, because the oils in our hair naturally, like, we are mammals. So our, it's similar to our hair oils, basically, and that's why it worked for them. Mm-hmm. And the way they got it to stand up, now this is for women mostly, because, you know, men did wear wigs more often than women. Like, this theory that women only wore wigs back then is also false. Like, it usually was if they couldn't style their own hair. It was usually, though, them styling their own hair and then having a lot of hair pieces included. And as for the men, yeah, they did wear powdered wigs. Some went without, though, as well. So the way women took care of their hair, though, is, you know, today we believe that washing your hair constantly is what, you know, keeps it healthy. And it's not wrong, as long as you're not washing it, like, too much, because that'll dry it out. But what they did back then was different, but it wasn't unhealthy. It was just a different way of taking care of the hair. So they would first put, like, the pomade in, which would seem like really greasy. So then they would put the powder in it, which I believe American Duchess recommends using cornstarch if you wanted to try it yourself. There you go. But yeah, it did taint, like, it did, like, color their hair to an extent. Like, if you had brown hair and you were using the white powder, that would give it a sort of gray look, which is the more iconic one. But they also had, like, lots of different colors. They had blue, purple, pink, and, like, even, like, brown. So, like, it, you know, the people who have their hair just looking like they don't have any powder in it, it's probably because they just have decided, like, someone like Belle, if she were to use, like, she would probably use powder because that's what cleanliness, you know, helped with cleanliness back then. So she probably would have used it, not in the movie, I'm saying, but, like, in real life in the 18th century, that's just what cleanliness was. And she probably would have had, like, a more natural looking powder to match her hair color because she just, you know, is more natural like that. She wouldn't have had, like, white or blue in mind, I'm guessing. Actually, she probably would have had the least expensive kind, to be honest, which I don't know what that would be. But anyway, so the powder you put on over the pomade. And so now that it's, and that removes the greasiness of the pomade, and it actually makes it, like, really, like, easy to mold. So, like, if you're making dough, if you were to mix flour with, like, the oil, that makes a dough that you can mold and shape, and it makes your hair easy to style in those styles, which is super, it's like baking, but for your hair, and it makes it easy to work with. And, you know, they wouldn't wash it. It would just be, like, more pomade, more powder, which sounds gross to, like, modern ears, but actually they would comb it out. So they would put the pomade in and then powder it to, like, get rid of the grease. And they would just comb it all out to get rid of, like, anything that was not considered good. And again, the pomade natural and the powder wasn't unhealthy. It just made it easier to mold and was the style. So, yeah, their hair was clean, really. It had powder in it, so it wasn't like what we would use today, but it wasn't dirty. And because of the powder included so much in it that deterred pests, so they really actually helped avoid lice and bugs or whatever. So that was just how they kept cleanliness. So, like, pretty much everybody would be using pomade and powder because that was hygiene back then, which I think is interesting. So that's pretty much all I have. You have more?
No, that's all. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Yeah, and tune in next time we have an episode. We don't know when that will be yet, but hopefully in a couple weeks.
And, it is.
Stay tuned.
Bye. You want me to start the ending?
Do you want to try? Because I tried it several times, and I'm like, well, that's terrible.
Okay, sure. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Yeah, thanks.
We hope that you enjoyed our podcast. Please continue.
Hello?
Fuck.
We'll just put that as the ending. Just fuck. That's it. Bye.
You know, I actually really like that ending.
It's like, what? Is it over?
That is my kind of ending.
Okay, let me try starting again. If you enjoyed
enjoyed this podcast, please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. To stay up to date on new episodes, don't forget to subscribe. For more content, find us on Instagram and Facebook at Tailcoats and Tiaras. You can tune in every other Tuesday for new episodes. See you next time!